Arm's Length Reporting, for investors who want the whole story. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
For KER Politics, got a really great show for you this week. We're going to start out the second half of the program chatting with John Reed. John was an anchor on Fox News. He was also, interestingly enough, on CBC. UCLA Film School grad, spent a lot of his time in California, so we will be getting his insights as to what's going on in California. John currently has just released a nonfiction book. It's a mystery. It's entitled Death in the Reeds. Main character is Mickey Judd. Prior to that, he wrote three nonfiction books, which were also published. One is called Hating America, the New World Sport, which he wrote while he was at Fox. The second one was entitled How the Left Swift Boarded America. And then the final one is entitled The War on Christmas. Tell us about your new fiction series, will you, John?
Sure. Thanks, Al. Thanks for having me on. So there's two of them that are Mickey Judge mysteries. One's called O.J.'s Knife, which we know that knife, in fact, was never really found. But in my fiction book, O.J.'s Knife by John Gibson, the two guys find the knife, and then an adventure ensues. The new one is called Death in the Reeds, and it's about an antiquity that, in fact, was stolen from the Iraq Museum at the start of the Iraq War. And in this story of fiction, once again, we follow the guy who stole it and then see what happens to him. And then we follow the object itself as it heads to San Francisco, where one of Mickey Judge's friends is trying to sell it to a Silicon Valley billionaire. And so the story unfolds in San Francisco about this stolen antiquity. And I can't give away the end. I can just tell you that Death in the Reeds is an exciting read, and it's available on Amazon.com. I just want to read you this. I just got this from a review of O.J.'s Knife, and the reviewer said, a riveting read from cover to cover. It's all the more impressive when you consider it is Gibson's debut as a novelist. So I got an endorsement from the Midwest Review of Books, and I urge you to go to Amazon.com and get Death in the Reeds by John Gibson.
John, that's really, you know, it's really an honor to have you on. You've had a lot of experience in, multiple major news organizations, MSNBC, as one of the daytime anchors there, covering, I understand, the Clinton Lewinsky scandals in the early 90s. What was it like being there doing that type of thing?
Well, you know, in the early days of MSNBC, and the same held true for Fox, anytime there was a hot story, we glommed onto it and didn't give up until the ratings just crashed. I used to say we always went one day too long. And, for instance, we were doing Princess Diana coverage a year after her death at MSNBC. Wow. And the Clinton Lewinsky scandal was obviously, you know, a big breaking news story. So that went on for, the length of that story. And we were doing it every day, every hour. In fact, I used to have to do Keith Olbermann's show because he objected to the story and would sit at home in his bathtub smoking a cigar, arguing with the producers about whether or not he was going to come in. And, I would be checking in with the boss every, like, hour saying, is he coming? Is he coming? Is he coming? And if he wasn't, I had to do his show, which led me to call him Bathtub Boy. And we got into a big feud that has lasted to this day, as a matter of fact. The early days of MSNBC and Fox were both the same thing, as struggling to gain an audience, absolutely struggling. When I started at Fox, I started the 5 o'clock show. They told me if you could get a 500,000 viewers, it's a hit show. 500,000 would be stunning. By the time I left, I was doing 1 million. By comparison, that same hour, the five right now, does almost 3 million every day. So yeah. There's been an exponential growth in cable news viewing since I was in it.
You know, what's very interesting to me is, you know, you talk about the push with anchors and journalists and research teams, right? You're back, the people in the back rooms that are, you know, kind of digging this stuff up, and the reporters and the, you know, out there on the street trying to get information. And it's very strange today that you have very selective efforts by major corporate media to target specific events or say, let's say the Mar-a-Lago raid, but then they completely ignore, say, the Hunter Biden story. Why do you think that is?
The three networks had to choose a lane to be in. And Fox created this dynamic by saying overtly, we're conservative. What MSNBC, when it launched, and it launched ahead of Fox, so there was just CNN and MSNBC for a few months. And MSNBC said, we're going to do the news. We're going to be right down the middle. If we get into a partisan fight, your job, John, is to beat up both sides equally.
Yeah.
And they, as Fox came on and took the conservative lane, they realized that wasn't going to work. And so both CNN and MSNBC gravitated towards their natural political position, which was a liberal position. And so here we are today. What has happened is Fox is still conservative, although a lot of people think it's gone too far to the center. CNN has suddenly decided, with the recent acquisition, change of ownership, we're going to just do news. All that opinion stuff from Jake Tapper and Don Lemon, that's gone. You're not going to hear that anymore. And MSNBC has decided the far left is their lane, the very progressive far left.
Kind of the nut jobs.
Yeah, well, what Roger Ailes used to refer to as out where the buses don't run.
Yeah.
And you know, and apparently MSNBC is fairly successful at this. I you know, sort of follow the ratings, but they have a big audience of young progressives, old line liberals, African Americans, and they take a far left line unabashedly. I mean, I think they've become basically a racist station, but that's their lane. Fox has chosen a kind of a wider lane of conservatives and sort of centrists, and, you know, and some Trump people who aren't mad at Fox. I think there are probably a few Trump people who are not mad at Fox, but a lot of them are.
Yeah.
And so what really has happened, and I think Fox made this happen. Roger Ailes made this happen. He made media come out of the closet. So you've been hiding in there pretending you're objective and right down the middle. We know you're liberals. We're going to be conservative, and sure enough, the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, MSNBC...
Got less than a minute, you guys.
Burst out of the closet and said, we're liberals, and we're going to fly our freak flag. And that's where we are today.
Well, it's an interesting dynamic that we see out there in the media. And it's interesting to see with the internet and the pressure on, you know, click, how many clicks and how you measure, you know, resources and... It's a very difficult and challenging environment for getting the word out in sort of a just, you know, news and having what you had talked about, people really digging deep and pushing both sides. We don't see that much anymore.
You don't see that much anymore. Jimmy, you got to take a real quick commercial break here. I'm really interested in talking in the next segment with you, John, about specifically your views about what's going on in California. You spent a fair amount of your journalistic career in California. You've got some very interesting opinions. Big Al certainly wants to hear what you're going to be talking about. Be right back, you guys.
Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Politics for this weekend show. We've got a fantastic guest, John Gibson, former Fox News anchor, MSNBC, a lot of journalism experience. And then, of course, we talked about his book in the first segment there that he's got just published. And so you want to look up John Gibson on Amazon to try and get the Killer in the Reeds? Say it again, John.
It's Death in the Reeds.
Death in the Reeds. Gibson,
if you go to Amazon and just put that in there, you can order that book and it'll be there in a couple of days. It's a Mickey Judge mystery. Mickey Judge is a troublemaking TV reporter.
Hey, Jimmy, I really would like to get over into what John has to say about what's going on in California. California has got some very interesting political events going on right now. I'd like to talk about those.
Yeah, you know, let me just so people know out there, in full transparency, open kimono, if you will, I grew up in Sacramento area, and John was a reporter at KCRA, which is one of the lead NBC stations in the area, and I think you actually talked San Francisco. You did the San Francisco beat, is that right, John?
Yeah, I did. Feature stories in the gold country for about a year for KCRA, and then I got the job being the San Francisco Bureau. So I was there probably close to 15 years doing stories in the Bay Area for KCRA in Sacramento.
Well, what do you think of San Francisco now? My son lives
there.
it's
hard to ruin such a great city, but they're working on it. They're really getting close. I think what's going on is, first of all, people need to understand, a few years ago, California became a one-party state.
Yes, it did.
There essentially are no Republicans except out in the Central Valley. That's where Kevin McCarthy is from. Kevin McCarthy is from Bakersfield. And in California, a Californian on the coast would consider Bakersfield a joke, a place that you fly over or drive through as fast as you can. But other than that, it is a blue bastion with a couple little red dots out in the middle. And what you've got is the dictatorial policies of the progressive left at work. They're lucky that they have the tech industry to suck money out of, and they can fund a lot of these projects that are so stupid. But what's really going on, and I think the challenge for the country, is the governor there, who has led all of this, Gavin Newsom, wants to be president. And we are going to be treated to Gavin Newsom running for president and trying to tell America, you want to be more like California. And I just think that, with a couple of exceptions, let's say Massachusetts and let's say New York, that most people would be horrified to think that they were about to become California. You were talking, I know we talked earlier about, people going to school boards and raising hell about what's going on in the classroom. Let's remember something. Because of security now, parents are not allowed in the classroom. They don't know what's going on in there, except when they see it on TikTok. And now they're finding out that their kids are being groomed into transgenderism. And I think that you're going to see a revolt pretty soon, and a lot of action in school board elections and local elections to try to correct this swing to the far, far left. That's what I think is going on. And by the way, I also think that there is a good chance, if Trump and Biden would disappear from the scene, that we could have the best election ever with DeSantis versus Newsom. And that would be a left-right war that would decide the fate of this country. Whichever way it goes, so goes the country.
Any predictions on that one, John?
I don't think Gavin Newsom can win.
Tell us why.
I just don't.
I really hope.
Well, because, look, what Democrats depend on is the overvote of California and New York. What they always want to tell the country is, you know, the Republicans threaten democracy. What they mean is we have millions of extra votes on the coasts, therefore we should win. The country is a republic. The big square states in the middle also get a voice. And that's where the elections are won or lost. Biden won, he had 7 million more votes than Trump, but he only won in the states that counted by a few thousand votes. Same thing when Trump won. So I think out in that area that decides the way the country goes, they'd be horrified at the prospect of becoming California.
You know, it's pretty apparent with, and I think I agree with you that what is not being counted in the polling right now is this level of frustration from parents with what's happening in the classroom, with the COVID lockdowns that kept children out of school for education, with the mandates, all those issues. And where it was apparent last year was in Virginia, where Youngkin won, and of course the entire leadership switched from Democrat to Republican, and they kept their House and their Senate or their state legislature Republican. And then what you saw in Florida in these primary elections and these local elections where school boards were flipped in Miami-Dade and some of these very leftist areas to conservatives. I do think that there is a real level of frustration with voters that are certainly underrepresented by polling, because they typically aren't that involved or don't care that much, but they care a lot now. And then you're also seeing this alienation, this attack on voters that absolutely support America First, that supported Trump, whatever you want to call it, that actually really believe in America and believe in the basic fundamental, you know, principles that we were kind of, you know, brought up with to believe in. And this, they're angry with this attack on all our history, all our culture, by, you know, social engineering to make
1 minute, you guys.
Yeah. And I think, I think this is a really interesting time to see, but the media is the key element to educating people on this. And we don't see anything effective in good counter media.
Well, this is what you're going to see. Somebody's going to get the idea that the motivating factor is the left saying they're not your kids, they're ours. They belong to us. That will cause these people to rise up. They may blow off everything else. But I know we're running out of time, so let me just say thank you guys for having me on. And once again, the book is Death in the Reeds, The Mickey Judge Mystery by John Gibson. It's on Amazon.com. And I really appreciate you guys giving me a shot to tell people about the book and discuss the politics in my favorite state in the nation, my home state, California.
Time for the top of the hour news, you guys. John, it was great having you on the show. We'd like to get you back. Thanks for coming.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
And for more KER politics than the last half of the show, we are featuring a very, very interesting guest. His name is Abdul Jamal Hassan. Mr. Hassan was born in 1986 in the Zermatt district of Afghanistan's southeastern Paquita province. He's got a degree in poli-sci, political science, from the Kabul University. And before serving with the coalition forces, which he did from 2008 until 2012, he worked as an English as a second language area supervisor. He has just published a book entitled Promises Betrayed. And in the foreword of this book was written by General David Petraeus. Very important book because it gives what we feel is a very accurate description of the American withdrawal from that region. Jimmy, you want to start out?
Yeah, so again, it's an honor, Jamal, to talk to you. And and make sure that everybody out there knows that your book is available on Amazon and easily ordered, Promise Betrayed, an Afghan interpreter's interpreter at the fall of Kabul. And I think, I guess I need to start out with this. Just give us a brief, you know, summary of the challenges you personally and your family faced as things began to collapse, beginning in that spring and up until the August withdrawal.
Well, initially, I was working until July the 15th of 2021 at the NATO's headquarters in Kabul. And then I was released because the mission ended, and I spent 1 month preparing for my SIV interview at the U.S. Embassy, which was due on the 30th of August last year. And then on the 15th of August, I was at home supervising a group of painters painting a room for my brother's wedding, which was also due in 2 weeks' time. And then I got a call from my brother-in-law saying that I shouldn't leave the home because there were Taliban everywhere, which wasn't something I could believe, because there were thousands of Afghan forces in Kabul plus foreign forces, and there was this agreement that the Taliban would not enter Kabul city until a power sharing government was established. But then things started to fall apart quickly, and when I turned on the TV, there were Taliban everywhere. When I opened the window of the balcony to see outside, there was smoke rising from the U.S. Embassy and the NATO's headquarters, which brought me to think that they were burning some sensitive materials. And there were Chinook helicopters flying over Kabul city trying to evacuate people from different embassies and bases to the Kabul International Airport, which was the final outpost for the international community there. And then for 3 days, my family did not allow me to leave home because there were Taliban everywhere. And then on the fourth day, August the 18th, I got a text from a friend in Italy about an evacuation by the Italians, with whom I had worked from 2008 to 2010. I grabbed my family, my wife, my two-year-old daughter, and we ran to the airport, only to find out that the evacuation by the Italians was canceled for 3 days. And then I was left with the two choices, either to leave, go back home, or stay there and try my best to get onto the airport. Luckily, the following day at 1 o'clock in the morning, I mean midnight, I showed my SIV documents to the U.S. Marines. They allowed me inside and with my family, but then the real chaos started from there. For 36 hours, me and my family were at the Kabul airport with thousands of people. Absolute chaos. A scene I will never forget in my life. And for 13 hours, I was separated from my wife and my daughter, and no one can imagine what would have happened to them. My wife thought that I was killed amid the chaos. I was trampled, and so many other thoughts went through her mind. And then from there, we were evacuated to Qatar, to Al Udeid Air Base, and we had to stay for 7 straight hours under 50 degrees Celsius on the tarmac because there were no buses to evacuate us to the places where we had to be taken. And then at every 30 minutes, an Afghan evacuee was fainting out, and then there was ambulance taking them, and I was translating for the 450 people on a C-17. I was the unofficial interpreter for that leg of the journey. And then from there, we were taken to Germany for a week. We were there under very harsh conditions, cold weather, raining, and no proper food, no proper accommodation, no blankets. It was a terrible experience. And then we were taken to Virginia. From there, we were taken to the U.S. Army base Fort McCoy at Wisconsin, where we spent 65 days. And basically, since the moment we entered the U.S., treachery, our luggages, our bags, clothes, everything, our belongings, our documents, they were separated from us, and we got them back after 6 months.
Well, I'm curious about one thing. Now, your book basically tells the real story of America's war on terror in Afghanistan and how the current administration's actions have really failed not only America but our allies, and most of all the freedom-loving Afghani allies who were left behind. Tell us a little bit about that, would you?
Yeah, so as you said, there are plenty of details about the failure, either in the military part or in the civilian part, by the international community in my books with plenty of detail. So the things that started to fall apart for the military was starting with an announcement by President Obama in 2010, when he said that we will end the combat mission in 2014, which gave a kind of incentive for the Taliban to wait out the foreign forces, which they did. And then when the Afghan forces took full responsibility for security in Afghanistan, the Taliban attacked them fiercely and incurred lots of casualties on the Afghan side. And then when the Doha Agreement was signed initially under President Trump, things were a little bit on the right path, because under President Trump, the withdrawal would have been a condition based, meaning that if the Taliban stopped attacking foreign and Afghan forces, if they preserved, protected, and respected human rights and the gains of the past 20 years, the international forces will withdraw. Otherwise, they would stay there. And also, President Trump took Taliban responsible for their actions. That is an example. In 2019, when he was supposed to meet senior Taliban leaders at Camp David, when a suicide attack killed a U.S. soldier in Kabul, and that's when he canceled the visit. So he took Taliban responsible for the actions. But unfortunately, though people say that the Doha deal, the deal between the Taliban and the U.S. was a mistake, the current administration continued with that mistake despite knowing it was a wrong deal. And unfortunately, when the U.S. delivered all parts of its promises made to the Taliban, the most important of which was the release of 5,000 Taliban prisoners from Afghan jails, the U.S. decided to leave overnight and did not take Taliban responsible for their part of the promises. They should not have attacked Afghan forces. They should not have run over provinces and districts. And certainly they shouldn't have entered Kabul city. None of Taliban were not taken accountable for none of these actions.
You know, Jamil, the impression, we've got less than a minute here, and then we'll be able to continue on in our final segment. But the impression and the argument that the current administration, I call the regime here in Washington, they argue that they got into a bad deal and they were stuck with it. But as you had pointed out, I think very appropriately, both serving there and serving when the initial discussions kicked off in the Persian Gulf area, in UAE and Qatar, that it was very much conditions-based. And the Trump administration was actually holding people fairly tightly to those issues. And, of course, the commander on the ground at RS, General Scott Miller, he was doing the same. And we're going to have to go to a break here. And we've got about just a few seconds left. And we'll come back with Jamil Hassan, Promises Betrayed, discussing Afghanistan withdrawal.
Politics. We're talking about Afghanistan right now with Jamil Hassan. Jamil has a book out entitled Promises Betrayed. Very, very interesting book, as Jim said in the last segment. You can pick this book up from Amazon. Jimmy, take over, bud.
Yeah, so Jamil, this the notion and the understanding by the American people is very different than actually the realities on the ground and kind of the changing momentum over two decades of involvement with NATO forces, with American forces, but most importantly with Afghans evolving into a sense of actually somewhat of identity and kind of breaking the historical chains. And the progress was slow, but it was moving in the right direction. And all of a sudden that stopped. And I think my question to you is, you worked in Resolute Support headquarters, you worked in ISAF headquarters in Herat with the Italians. I was there with, at some point, probably around the same time you were there, down in Balabaluk and Farah province. And then you see this massive training mission, the expansion of a military force, but something happened towards the end there in the springtime with the Taliban offensive, and the U.S. and NATO forces just sat back and watched the Taliban take over positions. Why do you think that happened?
Well, the improvement you can see both in the military part of the Afghan forces and in the civilian part of the Afghan government. Since 2014 and up to 2021, all the security was maintained only and solely by the Afghan forces. We had a 300,000 Afghan force that included special forces, and the special forces included Afghan women, which is not something that you can find in our neighboring countries, in Pakistan, India, in Tajikistan, Central Asian countries. So that was we had a solid, strong force. And what was necessary for them was the support from the international community, from the U.S. Military, the air support, the contractors that maintained the air assets of the Afghan forces. And on the civilian part, we had, just to give you some examples, we had over 6 million girls going to school. And now all those girls are at home. None of them can go to school. We had so many achievements that it will take hours to explain all of them. And when the negotiations with the Taliban began, and then slowly, especially under the current administration, the tide changed towards the Taliban. The current administration favored the Taliban over the Afghan forces. And since the beginning of 2021, they withdrew the critical support to the Afghan forces. They did not provide the proper ammunition that were needed. And the Afghan military, the Afghan police, they fought until the very last day. But unfortunately, because you cannot fight two enemies at the same time along an ally that you think is an ally, but is not an ally actually, that's when things fell apart. Until the very last day, the Afghan forces thought that the U.S. military was there as an ally of the Afghan people, while in practice, they were favoring the Taliban. And you cannot believe this. When the fall of Kabul was completed, the senior Taliban leaders were brought in a U.S. military airplane from Qatar to Kabul. So everything was going in the right direction until the current U.S. administration started to favor Taliban more than the Afghan people.
You know, Jamil, that's actually consistent with what Biden had said as vice president publicly, that the Taliban was not the enemy in his mind. And I was actually involved. I was at the NATO summit in 2012 in Chicago with a NATO partner member when Obama actually was trying to plan the exit strategy and walk away and leave the Afghan people at that time. And of course, it was a very problematic period, but you know, we had seen such great changes and so many positive momentum, and there was so much investment by Western, by NATO allies, and that's not just NATO. It was actually 52 members of the coalition that were involved in actually helping stabilize the region. And we actually came to that point under General McChrystal and then followed on by General Petraeus. But then walking away that quickly, walking away by 2014 and leaving a very small force there, not doing anything. My son first deployed to Helmand Province in 2016, in the last few months of the Obama administration, and could take no action, even though Taliban were far attacking his positions. And at the same time, you know, they were, you know, you have this training mission, this dual problem that says, oh, we're going to train and equip, but we're not going to support. It didn't make any sense. Things changed in 2017 with kind of a fight to win policy and then a more proactive role. And that's what I think it's important for people to understand. It didn't take a large NATO or allied or U.S. force to do the very minor military actions in order to support Afghan forces to keep them strong and in the battlefield. Logistics, training, and then air support. And when that walked away, it, in my view, it was incredibly damaging for Afghan military forces. And of course, with the NSOC, the National Special Operations Unified Command that I actually worked with, made it very tough. And it seems to me that you combine that military problem and then walk away from the very positive civilian things that were happening there. And we talked off mic a little bit about the October 2018 elections and all the hope that was there. It made it very, very, very painful process to watch for those that served there. And I'm sure for the millions of Afghans that had saw hope on the horizon. What are your feelings about the people that are left and what happened right with this? And what will their feelings be in the future about other folks?
Yeah, you know, Jamala, before I answer that question, I want to ask you perhaps a bit of a simpler question, although it's along the same lines, and that is, I personally feel in America left the Afghanis holding the bag, for lack of better terms. What is the general impression of America today among the Afghanistan people?
Well, there are certainly lots of issues, to be clear. First, it was not an Afghan war. The U.S. was not attacked on 9/11 by the Afghan people. It was Al-Qaeda who were hiding, who were trained in Pakistan. Generally, the Democrat presidents and the Democrat administration here in the U.S., they always favored Pakistan or Afghanistan. Where was Osama bin Laden killed? Where was the Taliban leader killed? In Pakistan, but no action was taken against Pakistan. And until the very last moment, the U.S. generals advised President Biden to leave at least 2,500 troops in Afghanistan to safeguard the U.S. embassy and the achievements of the past 20 years in case the Taliban break their promises, which he decided against that.
And I just want to make it sure that I just want to follow up with that. And that is under congressional testimony by the Central Command commander and the theater commander, General Miller. Go ahead.
Exactly. And the general perception view in Afghanistan is that the U.S. betrayed Afghan people twice. First, when they left the Afghan Mujahideen alone, when they defeated the Soviets and they withdrew all support. And that's when the civil war in Afghanistan began, because there was no one to manage them, to control them with all these millions of dollars and thousands of millions of weapons there. And then now, despite all the 20 years of achievements, the Afghan people were again betrayed by the U.S. So the Afghan people see the U.S. As a partner that cannot be trusted anymore. And it's not only about Afghanistan. We can look at the world state. Why was Ukraine attacked by Russia? Because Russia thought that since the U.S. did not stay with its main ally in the war on terror, Afghanistan, it would certainly do not defend Ukraine. And that's when they attacked Ukraine. So now it's China threatening Taiwan. The other day or tomorrow, it will be Japan and South Korea thinking of other replacements for the U.S. as its ally. And look at Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia king does not answer Biden's phone. So what does that send? It sends a clear message that the world does not trust President Biden and the U.S. under President Biden as a trustable ally and as a leader of the free world.
Yes, and Jamal, we're going to have to end it here. We've only got a few seconds left. Your points are very well taken and understood by, I think, people here on these radio stations. So we thank you very much. Promise Betrayal, Jamil Hassan. Please take a look at his book on Amazon.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.